Ragtime to rock and roll. Part 26, Melody Lingers On. In our final episode, to the relief of the music profession, rock and roll turns out not to be the end of the world after all. Kenneth Moore hears from a few of the survivors and discovers that tradition is too strong to be destroyed, that all the world loves a love song, and that people in search of diversion still say, "Give us a tune."
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. I got the rocking pneumonia, I need a shot of rhythm and blues. I caught the rolling off the rider sitting down at a rhythm review. I roll over Beethoven, they're rocking in two by two. Well, if you feel it and like it, go get your lover, then reel and rock it. Roll it over, then move on up just a trifle further, then reel and rock with one another. Roll over Beethoven, dig these rhythm and blues.
The public figures who showed such alarm in last week's episode weren't the only people who prepared to meet their doom when rock and roll arrived. The established entertainers took fright as well. They tended to react in one of two ways. They either assumed that the 4 minute warning had gone and that the next sound they heard would be the last trump itself, or they took comfort from the fickle nature of popular taste and hoped that rock and roll would prove to be just a passing fad. We know now that they were both wrong, and we hope to show you today a little of what really happened. Before we do, though, it's worth reminding ourselves of the strength of the reaction within the music profession that rock and roll provoked, and it came from the very top. In a 1957 magazine article, Frank Sinatra is quoted as saying, "Rock and roll fosters almost totally negative and destructive reactions in young people." He also said that it was sung, played, and written for the most part by cretinous goons. "My only deep sorrow is the unrelenting insistence of recording and motion picture companies upon purveying this most brutal, ugly, degenerate, vicious form of expression."
Tooling down the highway doing 79. I'm a twin pipe popper and I'm feeling fine. Hey, man, dig that. Was that a red stop sign? Fusion, transfusion, I'm just a solid mess of contusions. Never, never, never gonna speed again. Slip the blood to me, bud. I jump in my rod about a quarter to nine. I gotta make a date with that chick of mine. I cross the center line, man, you gotta make time. Transfusion, transfusion, oh man, I got the cotton picking convolutions. I'm never, never, never gonna speed again. Shoot the juice to me, Bruce.
It's hard to decide after all this time whether that was meant to be a joke or not, but it was pretty sick anyway. Nervous Norvus with the gory transfusion. Frank Sinatra's quoted comments just now were typically extravagant, and Ted Heath, on this side of the Atlantic, may have put his dislike of rock and roll a little less forcefully, but as Mrs. Moira Heath remembers, his reactions were still pretty strong.
He hated it. He called it Mickey Mouse music. And, you know, he said it's amateurish and it sounds like amateurs, which was true, it did. This is when he started having bigger and more, I suppose, involved arrangements. And he started having a harp when he recorded, or bringing in something different, just purely to prove that musicianship was still very important and that the musicians that could play their instruments well counted very much.
Well, Wee Papa Lula, she's my baby. Wee Papa Lula, her doming neighbor. Wee Papa Lula, she is my baby. Wee Papa Lula, her doming neighbor. Wee Papa Lula, she's my baby. Well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of the other team. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, be Bopalooza, she is my baby. Be Bopalooza, don't make me there. Be Bopalooza, she's my baby, I'm a baby. Let's kiss the wife.
It's like a 10-cent store taking over a great luxurious department store. And the 10-cent store takes over the whole block.
Songwriter Johnny Mercer in a fit of professional gloom.
The new music to me is unmelodious. The new words are illiterate. Generally speaking, there are exceptions, of course. Some of the shows have intelligent writers, and some of the songs are written intelligently, but 90% of them are like children playing with guitars or ukuleles, not knowing what they're doing.
Johnny Mercer's reaction to rock and roll was a fairly common one, and professional songwriters suffered from it perhaps even more than the skilled instrumentalists did. Their preoccupation with words probably gave them a heightened awareness of the age they lived in. Alec Wilder, the songwriter, composer, and author, whose tart remarks have seasoned one or two episodes in this series, brings events into very sharp focus.
The age of the record buyer has lowered each decade, so that 40 years ago, there wouldn't be any people under 20 buying records, practically. They didn't have any money. They got allowances. They went to work and they made just enough to live on. The affluence started coming in and the permissiveness started coming in and the age dropped until a 10-year-old could spend $50 a month on records. So as the demand on the part of the listener became less demanding, the music got worse because there was no demand for better music. Plus the fact that youth was in charge.
I'm so young and you're so old. This, my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I, we will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh, please stay by me, Diana. Thrills I get when you hold me close. Oh, my darling, you're the most. I love you, but you love me. Oh, Diana, can't you see? I love you with all my heart, and I hope we will never part. Oh, please stay by me, Diana.
The Rock came in, and it's still going on, and I, for the life of me, can't understand it because it's horrible. Outside of 8 or 10 writers, there's nothing that you can really care about. If you know the wealth of the 30s and the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the early 50s, puts to shame what's being written today.
Harold Arlen, composer of such numbers as Over the Rainbow, One for My Baby, and Stormy Weather.
The percussive instruments have taken place of the melodic line, and they seem to be in front of the music business today, and we thought really we were through with them 10 years ago, and they're just as bright and as noisy as they were then. And young children are buying the records, and the oldsters haven't anything to say about it.
Ooh, wee, you sure look good to me. You're
driving me crazy. I'm as happy as a man can be. Ooh-wee, you sure look good to me. Ooh-wee, you sure look good to me. You're driving me crazy. I'm as happy as a man can be. Ooh-ah, I want you to rock with me.
Well now, we've heard quotations from two performers and three songwriters. Let's even things up a bit with a third performer, trombonist George Chisholm, remembering his professional reaction to rock and roll.
Bill Haley and his Comets, I think he was called, were on, and this tenor player, an aged gentleman who found it rather difficult to lie on his back, did in fact lie on his back and play the tenor saxophone, and everybody fell about. They thought it was great, and I thought, oh God, what has music come to? It's like putting funny hats on and you know, and going forward and say I like to play Stardust, you know, with a funny hat and a red nose. You just don't do that.
Rock record that I recognize. I was staying in New York and I was playing on Broadway. I had a show there in 1955 called Joyce Grenfell Requests the Pleasure, and I heard a rock record for the first time, and I was fascinated by it. I wasn't shocked or put off, as perhaps some of my generation might have been. I thought it was very fascinating, but it didn't seem to me to replace anything. It was simply, I thought it would be a passing fancy. I'm surprised that it did as much as it did. But you see, there is still room for tunes. I mean, go back to the 60s. The Beatles write tunes. And there are some tunes about now.
Joyce Grenfell presenting the other view that rock and roll would be a fad. Miss Grenfell also gave us the text, if you like, for our final episode. There are some tunes about now, she said. Well, as a matter of fact, in spite of all that's been said, there were some tunes about then, too. Or at any rate, the period wasn't exclusively rock and roll. If you look at the top 10 for a succession of weeks in those late 1950s years, you find that something like 60% of the records do fall outside the rock and roll category. Typical of them was a number like Tammy.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. The old hooty owl, hooty hoos to the dove. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. Does my lover feel what I feel when he comes near? My heart beats so joyfully, you'd think that he could hear. Wish I knew if he knew what I'm dreaming of. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love.
one of the sweeter elements in what can look at this distance like the exclusively hard-hitting period of rock and roll. Some people, although they may not have realized it at the time, used rock and roll as the way into show business generally. That applies especially to all four of the young men who actually introduced rock and roll to this country. They first came into our story a couple of weeks ago as coffee bar habitués. Tommy Steele went fairly swiftly onto films, the stage, and superstardom. Wally Wyton expanded what he was doing already to become well-known on television and radio as a performer and presenter of folkish and children's material. Mike Pratt became an actor. Lionel Bart, in less than 5 years, had become the most successful author and composer of British musicals since, well, there hadn't ever been anyone quite like him, because Lionel Monckton and Leslie Stewart and composers of that kind had always collaborated with someone else. And Lionel Bart made his greatest impact on his own. Not at first, though. He came to the notice of a wider public by writing what he insisted on calling the song words of the show which inaugurated the Mermaid Theatre in 1959. The music was Laurie Johnson's, and it was a good combination, for according to Tommy Steele, lyrics had always been Lionel's greatest strength.
Lionel Bart's lyrics are the greatest. There's only one lyric writer, to my mind, that can match Lionel on his heyday, and that's Larry Hart. That's how great a Lionel is to me. His music leaves a lot to be desired. His temperament leaves a lot to be desired, but then so did Larry Hart's. So I think we can forgive temperaments and this sort of thing when you imagine lyrics.
Patience is a virtue that very few possess, and I confess I feel myself possess it less and less. But then if you've already lost one virtue, how on earth can losing one more hurt you? When does the ravishing begin? You confess me with a pin, so much sin I'm holding in. Men come and catch a sitting hen who is contemplating, when does the ravishing begin? Oh, must I wait in this state for the pretty fellow, for illustrate what they made him a pretty fellow for? I've a mind to incline to the pretty fellow more and more. When does the ravishing begin? Though my smile is coy and winsome, it's fixing in a grin. I'm in his grip, but he will not take a liberty. For when does the ravishing begin? La 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 dee 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 dee. La 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 di ti ti ti. La 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 di ti ti ti. When does the ravishing begin? You confess me with a pin, so much sin I'm holding in. Men come and catch a sitting hen who is contemplating, when does the ravishing begin? I shall swoon very soon, for the fellow has me weak at the thought of the scorn, and the fellow has me meek and as mild as a child, till the fellow has me cheek to cheek. Oh, when does the ravishing begin? Though my smile is coy and winsome, it's fixing in a grin. I'm in his grip, but he will not take a liberty. Oh, when does the ravishing begin?
Hi, Hazel. With When Does the Ravishing Begin, from Lock Up Your Daughters, Henry Fielding's Rape Upon Rape, adapted by Bernard Miles, music by Laurie Johnson, lyrics by Lionel Bart. In fairly swift succession came the Theatre Workshop production of Things Ain't What They Used to Be, words and music by Lionel Bart, and then the most commercially successful British musical of all time, Oliver. In both style and subject matter, it couldn't have been further from Lionel's rock and roll starting point.
Rich gentlemen, happy boys, eat digestion.
Based on Dickens, Oliver confirmed the golden rule for musicals. Start with a strong plot, preferably one borrowed from another medium, like a book or a play. And if it happened to be familiar to most people already, then so much the better. Oliver Twist proved to be the perfect model. Oliver ran in London from 1960 to 1965. He went to Broadway, became a film, and even had a hit song in the timeless tradition of the big tear-jerking ballads. Because Georgia Brown sang it in such a ripe Cockney accent in the original stage production, it was not her version which got into the charts, but one by a young singer who had emerged heart on sleeve and in throat just at the start of the rock and roll era. Shirley Bassey. Oliver's long run took it deep into the Beatle era, and by so doing, helps to provide us with part of the theme of this final installment of our story. That, no matter what the dominant trend is at any given time, somewhere underneath it all, the thread of tradition continues. The Beatles themselves, and the musical revolution they accomplished, are not really part of our narrative, for they began an era which carries us beyond the scope of this history. It's the end of an era we have to deal with. And that can be located with some accuracy in 1964. That's when Cole Porter died. No matter for how much longer conventional melody would continue, no matter how many more light-hearted musicals there might be, a certain type of song died with him. He wrote both words and music, of course, which meant he was comparatively rare. But it was the peculiar quality of his lyrics which made him absolutely unique. Like the stories in certain types of magazines, Cole Porter's songs usually dealt with a social world that most listeners weren't part of. We put the point to Johnny Mercer.
I don't think he could have done anything else. Cole Porter was born in a lap of luxury and raised in it and was accustomed to it. He moved in a milieu which was way above most of us. A very rarefied social atmosphere. And it came as natural to him to write about it as it does to Berlin to write what he writes. Cole Porter wrote about society people, he wrote about the Riviera, he wrote about royalty, he wrote about chic places, he wrote in a very sophisticated patois. He just was a very elegant, chic man.
I'm so in love, and though it gives me joy intense, I can't decipher if I'm a lifer or if it's just a first offense. I'm so in love, I've no sense of values left at all. Is this a playtime, affair of Maytime, or is it a windfall? Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long last love?
Lena Horne delivering every word of "At Long Last Love" as if it were a newly minted coin. That lyric, by the way, is the one Cole Porter began working on as he lay waiting for help after the accident which crippled him. The logical witness to call in dealing with Cole Porter as a creator of popular music is the man who has already been heavily involved in this series as the writer of the first 13 episodes. For it so happens that Benny Green had a major hand in bringing into being a whole evening's entertainment built around Cole Porter's songs. It's called Cole and is still packing the Mermaid Theatre after 6 months. Picking up from Johnny Mercer's observations on Cole Porter's rather elevated social standing, Benny puts his finger on why Porter could still write songs which were truly popular.
When he was at his best, I think he transcended mere classes. I think in a song, I don't know, like In the Still of the Night, which is really quite a simple vocabulary, in the chill still of the night, the moon on the rim of the hill, etc. They're very short words, very simple words. So he did have a knack. I don't mean he was complicated or verbose. On the contrary, some of his lyrics are very simple. But there's a kind of smartness to the whole style of Porter, which I think is a rich man's style. It's a rich man's smartness. But he wasn't a man that was cut off from simplicity. And I think some of the most moving songs are the simplest. I think I Concentrate on You, for instance, which is a beautiful ballad, which is often underrated. When wise men say to me, love's young dream never can come true. That's a very simple line, but it's very moving. And Porter was able to do this a great deal. What I really mean is that the technique and the money didn't eradicate the emotion.
Whenever skies look gray to me and trouble begins to brew, whenever the winter winds, they get too strong, I concentrate on you. When fortune cries nay, 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 nay to me, and people declare that you're true, whenever the blues become the only song, I concentrate on you. On your smile, that's sweet and it's so tender. When at first my kiss you do decline. On the light in your eyes when you surrender. Once again, our arms intertwine. And so when wise men say to me that love's young dream never comes true, to prove that even the wise men can be wrong, I concentrate on you.
Frank Sinatra concentrating on a Cole Porter lyric of deceptive simplicity. One of the most astounding things about Cole Porter was the fact that from 1938, when he suffered his appalling riding accident, until the end of his life, he hardly ever passed a day without great pain, yet he kept working. It suggests either that he used writing as a distraction or that he was an utter professional. Yet because of the hereditary wealth that we've already heard about, Porter never entirely escaped implications that he was a dabbler.
One thing that Porter used to be very upset by was the feeling that he was a dilettante. That drove him crazy. He used to say to people, just because I'm rich, people think I'm playing at this. And on the contrary, if a man writes 27 musicals, you don't play at it. 27 musicals is a lifetime of martyrdom. So he worked as hard and as long and as sincerely as any tough professional. And he hated the idea that he should be regarded as a dilettante. As to why he pushed himself, I think very simply he couldn't help it. That he knew that this stuff that he found sometimes fairly easy to write, sometimes not so easy, had to come out. It was a kind of artistic ambition. There was nothing to do with money. There was one curious thing, though, at the end, towards the end, by the time of Kiss Me, Kate, which turned out to be his masterpiece, he was already considered a bit passé, mistakenly, but considered a bit past it. And there was great difficulty in raising the money to put Kiss Me, Kate on, and Porter wouldn't put up any money of his own. And apparently this was one of his golden rules. Rich as he was, he would never put money up to back his own shows.
Why can't you behave? Oh, why can't you behave? After all the things you told me and the promises that you gave,
to his place in the history of Broadway, I think he summed it up in one of the nicest stories. Somebody played him a song, I think it was People Will Say We're In Love. It was one of the hits from Oklahoma by Rodgers and Hammerstein, and they said, what do you think of that? It's a lovely song. And Porter said, yes, but imagine it taking two people to write it. And there, I think, is the nub of Porter's greatness.
Well, with Cole Porter and Oscar Hammerstein dead, Irving Berlin uncommunicative and presumably inactive at the great age of 86, Richard Rogers now 72 and in poor health, and Harold Arlen eager to work but at 69 unlikely to be asked. It's not unduly dramatic to say that one era of the popular song is officially over. And in a sense, because we've heard, and who did not, the arrival of rock and roll, our task is over too. But nothing in history is ever cut and dried. There's always a succession. The melody is dead, long live the melody. Even the Beatles, who were said with some truth to have changed the world, still added to the great fund of popular melody. And the more conventional songwriting teams, Jerome Kern with his series of partners, Harold Arlen with his, Rogers with Hart or Hammerstein, were not without their descendants. They were different, certainly, but it was evolution, not revolution, at work.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so. Anyone who had a heart would let me in his love. loving you the way I do. I take you back. Without you I die, dear. Knowing I love you so.
Bert Bacharach wrote that tune, and Hal David wrote the words. The songs they collaborated on are so often referred to as Bacharach numbers that Hal David's essential contribution gets overlooked. And their partnership was a phenomenon of the early 60s. Although they were not quite like the songwriters of previous generations, they weren't part of the rock and roll scene either. They had to be regarded as belonging to a new wave of composers and lyric writers, as Hal David rather cautiously agrees.
I think what we did do and tried to do, and sometimes successfully, was to write with as much originality as possible. Also, not to fall into the trap, as we would from time to time, by seeking the offbeat and becoming contrived here and there, and try to write natural songs that had an element of originality.
Mother told always to follow the golden rule, and she said it's really a sin to be mean and cruel. So remember, if you're untrue, angels up to heaven are looking at you. You never get to heaven if you break my heart, so be very careful not to make us part. You won't get to heaven if you break my heart.
Oh. We wrote a song called That Kind of Woman, a jazz kind of blues semi-standard, I guess. We thought it was a very interesting song. And then it was recorded by Joe Mooney, very good singer, and the arranger thought, well, you can't have a 9-bar phrase, and he squared everything out to 8-bar phrases, a 10-bar, everything had to come out to an even number, and it took this very interesting song and turned it into one of the dullest lethargic records I've ever heard in my life, you know. And a few experiences like that, we suddenly listened to our demonstration records, and we realized we're making better demonstration records than the commercial records of some of our songs. So then we found Dionne Warwick, and we proceeded to record her.
If you see me walking down the street, and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
I guess that's part of each of us in the songs, and with success, we were able to indulge ourselves further into things that people would say, hey, you know, this isn't, you can't do this, you can't do that, because, you know, you just must have 8-bar phrases, or you must do this, or this must rhyme, or this mustn't rhyme, or you can't discuss this in a song, and then you'd find, well, with success, you thought, well, maybe you did know as much as they did know, and you tried it your way.
Stars that never were.
are parking cars and pumping gas.
The Burt Bacharach Hal David collaboration, made into a three-cornered affair for a long time by the inclusion of Dionne Warwick as the definitive interpreter of the songs. The Bacharach and David numbers, without belonging to the rock and roll world, were nonetheless obviously not as old-fashioned, either in tune or words. If you wanted an example of unashamed, juicy, conventional melody asserting itself in popular music against the apparent odds, you couldn't do better than go to something like this. Stranger on the Shore, which Acker Bilk recorded in the days when his recording manager was Dennis Preston. The interesting thing is that Acker Bilk's reputation was as leader of a traditional jazz band, a provider of jolly knees-up music. His whole image, bowler hat, fancy waistcoat and all, had been laboriously built up to that end. Yet he achieved his greatest fame, and incidentally sold about 2.5 million records, by stepping out of character.
I thought I was going to get hung, drawn, and quartered for doing that. It was Dennis Preston's idea. He said, "How about some clarinet with strings?" And I thought, well, you know, why not? Let's have a go at it. And I just played the melody. I didn't do much, nothing much to do with jazz. I recorded it in 1960, and it went to America for about a year before anything happened, you know. It certainly done all right. I mean, it was, I don't know, it was in the charts for 52 weeks, I think, something like that, which is in the Guinness Book of Records, apparently. I think that's top 50, mine, not top 10 or anything. But there you go.
Acker Bilk on Stranger on the Shore. In 1961, this next one didn't do too badly either.
Wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Old dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbows and waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend.
Andy Williams with Moon River, which is only one of a long run of successful compositions by Henry Mancini, all of which made it during the rock and roll and subsequent rock years. Except where a film or television score dictates otherwise, Mancini's music is almost invariably melodic in the traditional sense, and to him, that's how it should be.
In the huge overall scheme of things, you know, I think one thing is maintained, like from Italian opera right on down to the present day, and that's the melody. Everybody cannot sing, but everybody can hum, you know. But listening to a great melody and the ability to recreate that melody, the rememberability of it, you know, is something that I think is very important in popular music. And a lot of the composers, even up today, you know, that the right words and music, I think, don't even approach what Cole Porter did with words and music, or what Irving Berlin did with words and music, where they were on equal footing, you see. And I think today maybe the footing is more on the word rather than the melody. But yet, there have been enough melodies come down the road from 1900 for me to say that that I think melody is the secret. Melody is the thing that makes for memorable songs.
Heart from Henry Mancini's orchestra and chorus. And before that, Henry Mancini himself with a variation on today's theme that melody is the continuing thread. And he might have added melody's half-sister, romance. Because when we've finished with being witty and smart and significant, it seems that we turn in the end, at least as far as popular song is concerned, to the fragile comfort of romantic things. That's not simply an observer's opinion. It's the view of a singer who has always made his living proving it. Johnny Mathis, who's convinced that it's the ballad that survives.
First of all, because most ballads are about love or about romance, and that's what we're all seeking. We're all seeking love. We're all seeking to be accepted in some small way, in our own way. And when we have our quiet moments, I know it's true for me, we reflect on that love song. And it's kind of nice to be associated with this type of music, even though in concert I do many diversified songs, lots of fast songs, lots of what I hope are provocative, up-tempo songs. But yet and still, it's when people think of Johnny Mathis, they think of somebody walking around in front of a cloud singing Misty.
Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Walk my way, and a thousand violins begin to play. Or it might be the sound of your hello, that music I hear. I get misty the moment you're near. You can say that you're leading me on, but it's just what I want you to do. Don't you notice how hopelessly I'm lost? That's why I'm following you. On my own, would I wander through this wonderland alone?
never knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove. I'm too misty and too much in love.
What Johnny Mathis said just now is confirmed by Tony Bennett.
It seems that the melodic lines in music are the things that makes you get contact with music and makes you fall in love and makes you dream and makes you hope. Popular music, by the way, I think it's starting to come back now. Good music, all of a sudden, the rock groups are softening up and there's melodic lines coming back in. See, the rock groups, you know, the way I analyze that whole rock scene is that when Charlie Chaplin made it, everybody and his brother went out and did Charlie Chaplin contests all over America, and this became a rage for about 4 or 5 years. And when the Beatles made it, the impact was so solid and so definite that all these groups just emerged, and it became the age of the amateur. I mean, you know, they forgot that to write a song like Yesterday's took a little homework, a little sacrifice to come up with that good a melody.
Yesterday's, yesterday's, days I knew as happy, sweet sequester days, oh. Mad romance and love. Then gay youth was mine, truth was mine, joyous, free, and flaming life forsooth was mine. Sad am I, glad am I. Today I'm dreaming of yesterday.
I have taken comfort from one thing all my life, and that is whatever the market, whatever the vogue in music, the ballad remains inviolate. That which has melody remains inviolate.
Lyric writer Sammy Kahn speaking.
I don't care what seems to be the sound. The ballad remains inviolate. The good piece of music remains inviolate. It has to. 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000. If a man has food in his stomach, a roof over his head, he'll want to hear a ballad. And I hope to write it for him.
Call me irresponsible. Call me unreliable. Throw in undependable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? Well, I'm not too clever. I just adore you. Call me unpredictable. Tell me I'm impractical. Rainbow, I'm inclined to pursue. Call me irresponsible. Yes, I'm unreliable. But it's undeniably true. I'm irresponsible.
The indestructible combination of Sinatra at the peak of his powers and a Sammy Cahn lyric. And therein lies the paradox. By definition, popular music could very well be completely ephemeral and ought to be changing all the time. Yet here we are talking of permanence. What it boils down to is this. The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. And we have Irving Berlin's word for it.
It was the ragtime period, and then it went out and came jazz and swing and now rock and roll, and, you know, they changed the names, but the music more or less stays the same.
Irving Berlin has just summarized in 12 seconds has taken us 26 weeks to cover. And even so, there have been omissions. But it has been an extraordinary story. A story of art, industry, and grocery combined, where geniuses have gone on strike and morons have made fortunes. We've heard music, money, and machinery amalgamate to form the most powerful cultural force ever known. A force which has reduced the Atlantic to a narrow ditch and divided the world not by nationality or creed or speech, but according to age. Nothing in the long course of events has been predictable to the people taking part in them. The only wisdom that comes to the makers of popular music is that of hindsight. Who could have known at the point where we choose to end our part of the narrative that in only 10 years, ragtime would be back and office girls and housewives would know who Scott Joplin was.
Ragtime to Rock and Roll was narrated by Kenneth Moore. The series was written by Peter Clayton and Benny Green. The tape editors were Dave Dead, Ernie Horniman, Derek Mayle, and Brian Tuck. The research was by Bill Sullivan. The producers were Steve Allen and John Billingham, and the executive producer was Mark White.
And the voice that opened and closed each episode in the series was that of James Alexander Gordon.